Okay, Dr. Barbeau, you are up next. And if anybody doesn't get a copy that wishes one, would you please let us know, and we will make sure that a copy gets to you? Or okay.
Ready?
Dr. Barbeau, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name is Brad Barbeau. I'm a member of the faculty of Cal State University, Monterey Bay, and I'm one of the authors of the Barbeau and Mercer cost study. I'll try to make this brief. Okay. There are three cost studies, if you will, sitting out there right now. There's Appendix F in the waiver document that was done by the staff. There's the Barbeau and Mercer study of the cost of the ag waiver. And then there are some numbers out there also about the ag alternative. And primarily what I want to say about those is, first of all, the purpose of our cost estimate was to give growers an estimate of the cost of the proposed ag waiver and the ag alternative. It was not intended to be compared directly with the staff study. There are major differences between the objectives of those studies and major differences in the data sources for those studies. So I think the work that's been done trying to compare those two is maybe not the right way to approach them. And I'd say the same thing with the ag alternative. Rather than viewing them as competing, we would suggest that each of these reveals different parts of the elephant, so to speak, and provides additional information that can be used and should be used in understanding what the whole elephant looks like. Our study, trying to estimate the cost of compliance, and by the way, this was a very definite moving target as we were looking at it. We started with the March documents, and in the middle of our data collection, the May document came out. We tried to adjust as best we could, but were not able to entirely incorporate, and there have been changes since then also. Our data source was primarily grower interviews, so that's where we got our information from. So there's a good deal of uncertainty in these cost estimates, and that uncertainty is coming from several places. One big one being that we were all working with a moving target. As staff was working to adjust the their proposal, and also with the ag alternative, we were working with a very early version of the ag alternative. As you know, a lot of work has been done since then. So it is our feeling that doing responsible regulation requires a complete economic impact report that would include costs and losses to the growers, to the taxpayers, and looking at the indirect and induced impacts, economic impacts of the regulation, and that would also look at, in a systematic way, and this has not been done in any systematic way at all, and it's not easy to do, the gains and benefits of the regulation. That would be a complete economic impact study. And as Kay suggested to me in a conversation earlier today, if you're interested, we would be very interested in working on that if you would like that study to be done. So that's in the future. I think the conclusion that I would want to say and leave you with here is that I believe that this regulation absolutely has the potential to be a game changer. It changes the rules of the game, and it's going to cause an adaptive response, the outcome of which we do not know. There's questions about will growers go out of business or not. This is going to impact growers. It's going to impact what crops get produced. It's going to impact land use in ways that I don't think anybody has a crystal ball to exactly know what the ultimate outcomes are going to be. So if we wish to preserve agriculture in the region and also achieve our desired water quality, this requires a cooperative solution with cooperative implementation. And I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Sure. The reporter needs a quick break.
Two seconds.
If anyone is in the northern part of the region that needs to get out of here, or anyone locally that needs to get out of here by a certain time, I'll give those people 2 minutes each to advance when I would normally call them to address us now. Greg Pepping gave me his card, and he can come forward now. And you did say you submitted a speaker card, right? So you're going to... Okay. And these other three? Okay. These are... Okay.
What,
here, yes.
If you can have them for me, the people that are coming up when I'm there, if they could please say their name and spell their last name so I have it on the record, I would appreciate it.
Okay. Dr. Hunter, what we're doing is that there's some people that need to leave. They've been here. And so in exchange for going now, they got 2 minutes. Okay. All right? Okay.
Shrewd.
I'll tell you who I've got. Kent.
Hibben.
Looks like Nathan Alley, Charles Whitney, George Gutman. Okay.
Bob Martin.
Where's Mr. Martin's card?
It's in the stack.
It's in the stack. Okay, Mr. Martin. All right, let's go.
Go ahead.
Mr.
My name is Greg Pepping, P-E-P-P-I-N-G, an executive director of the Coastal Watershed Council. Thank you for taking my comments. The Coastal Watershed Council is a nonprofit based in Santa Cruz. We've been around since 1995, and our mission is to preserve and protect coastal watersheds through stewardship, education, and monitoring. Our monitoring work includes snapshot day, first flush, urban watch, effectiveness assessment on restored and constructed wetlands, as well as organic and sustainable farming practices. And offer that context so you have a background from which my comments are coming. We acknowledge that the Water Board staff has exercised due diligence in the process to date, and the net result of that process, what you're considering voting on today, has seemed to polarize many people, whether one considers themselves an environmentalist, a grower, both, or neither. You folks have a tough one today. I mean, if you pass this draft order, the way I understand it, it likely will be appealed or litigated, and go to the State Water Board, perhaps, maybe to the Supreme Court. And that does not result in water quality improvement. You do nothing and you're accused of kicking the can down the road, and obviously that is no improvement in water quality. In my opinion, one middle ground that would avoid litigation more likely and likely have one of the best chances of improving water quality is some middle ground that is approval of the draft ag waiver order as is, with 90 days for staff to incorporate alternative proposals such as Marcos Huertos and some other alternative approaches. That's what I recommend that you do. I encourage you to make a vote today because I think that's important, and I thank you for your work. I know it's a challenging decision. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Kent Hibben, if I pronounced the last name correctly, from Salinas. He had to leave. Is he coming back? No. Okay. Nathan Alley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got someone to cover my evening commitment, so I'll just stick around and go when it's my turn later.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Charles Whitney? Mr. Whit? He left?
Yeah.
Okay. George Gutman. Mr. Gutman. Okay. Mr. Martin.
Thank you. My name is Bob Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N. Actually, I'm here today representing Western Growers Association. They asked me to speak for them today. And Western Growers is a trade association with over 500 growers in the Central Coast region, including me, to express support for the comments made today by Farmers for Water Quality, the California Farm Bureau, and Dr. Mark Los Huertos. Instead of talking about the value of Central Coast Ag to the region, given the fact that I only have 2 minutes, I decided to focus more on the Q&A points that the board had for staff in yesterday's email that I saw. And in particular, question number 5, and regarding groundwater. And Chairman Young, you mentioned something earlier, kind of took a little wind out of my sails, but I just wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same plane with this. In recent documents, much emphasis is placed by staff proposal on the need to monitor nitrates in groundwater. Does staff realize that monitoring these levels in the coming years is problematic and places all farmers on a non-compliance mode? How does the regional board intend on dealing with this topic down the road? Many farmers like myself are attempting to tackle this problem and fully intend on minimizing their nutrient inputs to either decrease or eliminate nitrates in the groundwater. Immediate implementation is possible, but the ensuing results, although inevitable, are extremely slow to come. In other words, it's going to get worse before it gets better. And even staff member Matt Keeling acknowledged several decades possibly. I believe it would be more effective to measure the documented efforts of these farmers rather than just the nitrates in the groundwater. That will be the only true measure of what will occur in the far future, not just the next few years. I also take serious offense to the way the staff opted to classify farmers in the tiering system, stating that large operations have the potential to pollute as the leading criteria for selection. The sheer size of our operation is the only thing that allows us to spend the needed resources on accurate scientific equipment to accomplish goals of improving the quality of groundwater.
Mr. Martin, your time is up.
I'm sorry. If I was a small grower, those resources would be extremely limited, if non-existent.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Okay. Dr. Jean-Pierre Wolf.
And I feel funny to be on this side, but I'm Jean-Pierre Wolf, W-O-L-F-F, and I'm here representing myself as a agriculturist, a certified sustainable vineyard, and I have a few observations and suggestions that I'd like to make. I'll start with a little caption here that says it is much harder to break old habits than it is to learn new skills. Now, I think part of the discussions that we're hearing and seeing and is the fear of changes. My comments are going to be both on a macro level and a micro level. So I'm going to give you some 20,000 foot elevation observation and some that are very specific. Firstly, I suggest that we really try hard to keep the reporting as simple as possible. Efforts have been made with the notice of intent to streamline it, but I really feel we need to avoid using the analogy of a tax code that makes it so complex that you have to hire a CPA to do your tax return. And I think there's still some room on all three tiers to work in streamlining, making a little more simple the process. For example, I suggest, in addition to the regulatory document, that we develop more templates, guiders which are user-friendly, and add to the regulatory document a user-friendly version, because, yes, a regulatory document has to be written in a certain legalese language, but it doesn't necessarily make it a very easy document for a farmer. So I suggest that you translate a little bit some of the regulatory language into something that's a little more user-friendly. The cooperative monitoring program, I think, is very beneficial. Third-party groups, I think, will inherently add some cost to the program. And I think what you want to be cautious is not to add another layer of administrative body and further distance yourself from the agriculturist. Tier 1, 2, and 3, if I take the reporting of data, I think you probably have close to 80,000 data points between Tier 1, 2, and 3. And you got about 2,000 in Tier 1, that's 15 points per. Tier 2, you have 1,500. That was 25 points per, and then the balance is Tier 3. Well, that gets you right to 80,000. Now, I know we talked about GeoTrack, but, you know, GeoTrack is not a smart system. GeoTrack takes data. I mean, it doesn't have very sophisticated probabilistic software, trending program, Monte Carlo equations, etc. Because I think the big question is, it is very important to measure and get the information, but what are we going to do with it? And I think what we got to do with the information is make progress in water quality. So that brings me to the concern about adequacy of staff. You know, Mr. Jeffrey, you asked the question, do we have adequate staff? The answer was yes. But we heard earlier a recommendation to move on with the ag order, and then we can start working on other important issues. Well, the fact of the matter is that I do believe that administrating this ag order is requiring a fair amount of staff time, and you need to assure yourself that you do have the staff available. This is not a criticism at all to staff. I think the staff has done a very good job drilling into the issue. In fact, some people who argue too good of a job and others say not enough of a job. That's never here or there. I think you have done a great job. And I think Mr. Briggs, likewise, in managing the program. But if we look at the 175 pages of regulatory document, you know, the EO is peppered all over the place. In fact, if you do a word search, you will find probably 100 times the EO in terms of alternatives and other proposals, etc. Well, that's going to take time and resource. So my big concern is under the current budget cuts and limited staff is you do not want to set yourself up for failure. As a board, you know, the analogy is that you're impacting a multi-billion dollar business. So put yourself in the shoes of being the CEO and board member of a publicly traded company. And I don't think as a board member you would say, well, staff is adequate, all right, let's move on. I think you would want to have a plan. So my suggestion is to have concurrently a plan that is basically a management plan showing what resources will be allocated to administer and implement this program, and therefore assured that for the environmental side, the water quality side, and also for the agriculturist, that we do have a successful story at the end. A couple of additional comments is that the water quality degradation has taken place over a long period of time. You know, I think we all agree there is a legacy associated with it. And surface water probably can be mitigated a lot quicker than groundwater. And what I would suggest is you consider the deadlines that you have issued and maybe have some deadlines and milestones that are slightly extended. I'm not suggesting 8 years and 15 years, as I heard earlier, with, you know, some of the improvements. But, you know, you do have deadlines of 2014, for example, and we're already 2012, first quarter is over. So I think you want to give yourself a little more elasticity there. I think concurrently with the ag order and the regulatory side, you need to take a holistic approach to this. Regulation by itself will not solve our problem. It's going to require regulation, collaboration, education, innovation, research, and trust. But with a caveat on trust that I'll paraphrase President Reagan, trust but verify, okay? I think education was originally a requirement in the ag waiver, and now it is voluntary. There is a missed golden opportunity to bring together a little bit more of the ag community here with some program. Comments that I heard, the reason why education has been dropped out, it was not very successful in the ag waiver. Well, that's because there was not a whole lot of effort put into developing a good curriculum involving all parties. But there, it's a missed opportunity to promulgate best management practice, innovation, technology, new science, collaboration, including environmental communities. So if we leave the educational component as voluntary, it's going to be a little hush-posh of different parties having their own interpretation. Another point to make pertaining to the importance of assuring that you have the right amount of staff is that item 4, page 7, figure 1, which you showed earlier on the slide, shows irrigated ag having the highest degree of water quality impact beyond landfill, municipal, and urban stormwater, way to the right. That would tell me that you need to put a lot more effort in that area. And there's been millions of dollars of grants that have been provided to help agriculture. And so I think in this case, it would behoove you to consider committing the Regional Water Board to allocating resources analogous to the Central Coast Joint Effort for Hydro Modification Control and Low Impact Development, where you have a whole specific set of program to help assure or support the success of these proposed ag waivers. So in summary, I think that parallel to the regulatory language, there is a need to have a plan on how you're going to roll this out and assure success. And I would think, and I can't speak for my colleagues agriculturists, but you're going to have a lot more buy-in if people see that, okay, this is not just about regulating, it's also working together to make progress. One little item that I think perhaps should be modified is currently there is a requirement for Tier 1, 2, and 3 for groundwater sampling to hire a registered professional engineer, such as a hydrologist or a geologist, to take the sample and take it to a lab. No, agriculturists routinely take water samples. We know how to take water samples. You know, we know not to take a sample in a Coke bottle and take it to a lab. So I don't quite understand the logic in making that requirement, particularly since with your NPDES permit holders, you allow them to take samples themselves. You allow technicians in water treatment plants to take samples. It doesn't have to be done by a four-year degreed engineer. So I'm kind of missing that more stringent requirement. And if you're concerned about the QAQC of the chain of custody and the proper protocol to take the sample, where there was your golden opportunity of continued education or short course on water sampling, and you got it done. So I don't want to abuse of the generosity you gave me with the red light here, but I just wanted to give you a few views, and I apologize for my lateness in giving you feedback, but as you know, this has been a difficult position for me under the current laws of having to excuse and recuse myself from speaking. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Okay. Dr. Los Huertos.
Thank you, Chairman Young. I'm glad you can say my name.
I grew up in California. There's
a lot of people did.
Yeah. I mean,
let's see the problem with
my name. A little bit of a easy thing to do. Well, no comment, Mr. Jeffers.
So my name is Mark Los Huertos, L-O-S-H-U-E-R-T-O-S. I'm a faculty member at California State University, Monterey Bay. I've been working on water quality issues since 1992. In particular, in Elkhorn Slough, I've been working on vegetative buffer strips and nitrogen removal of the buffer strip to see how effective they were. Recently, I just almost finished a contract with Karen, who's a contract manager, looking at bioassessment of connecting algae to the numeric standards, which is a really hard thing to do. And we just completed that last year and I will have to say that after 15, 20 years of talking about the problems of nitrogen, that we're actually quite impressed that farmers would hire me during the summer to tell them all the things that they need to do to improve water quality. I think it speaks to the risks they've taken by hiring someone that's been someone that's critical of them for a long time, and on some level, getting ready to propose a very some scientific background of why a nitrate standard may need to be less than one part per million. They don't like hearing that. They also don't enjoy a lot of the conversations we have with them, but it's been, I think, one of the most provocative conversations I've had with farmers in 20 years. I think it says a lot to the seriousness of the region and the attention they have to this issue regarding water quality. I also want to back up a little bit. Another key experience that I've had, although I was not directly involved, was a group of growers in Quail Creek decided to worked with Water Quality Preservation, Inc. They did an independent and anonymous reporting of the water quality coming off of their farm. They had actually a board staff as inspecting the farms and going through their farm plans at the same time, and they had a dramatic reduction in pollutant loads. To me, this was dramatic reduction in pollutant loads. To me, this is probably one of the take-home messages of what I saw in the 2004 ag waiver was a profound and successful program that could engage growers in a way that had both a stick and a carrot, in a way that allowed the growers to respond in a way that they didn't feel like their laundry was hanging out for everybody, in a way that they could address water quality issues by installing, testing various management practices. And hopefully you can see that I've tried to use that model to continue to develop and refine the ag alternative proposal with some more details. So my initial proposal was to create a collaborative context for growers and technical advisor resources to improve water quality based on a reliable risk assessment. And I will have to diverge here slightly. I was actually quite surprised after Karen Worcester talked for 5 minutes about the importance of the Santa Maria Basin with serious water quality issues, and then to see Tier 3 growers, the quote, most risk-causing growers, to be almost absent in that basin. Only 3 or 4 points, I'm not sure how many, but somewhere. It was a fairly small number. And to me, that speaks to the lack of reliability of the tiering system. I think it's problematic. I spoke to that last year. I think it's based on assumptions about how water quality moves. And for me, as a scientist, I find that approach is not only turning into a sort of part of the divisiveness of the program, but it also sets a target on some of potentially the most innovative and capable growers that we have in our region. So I don't want to belabor that point, but I think the staff presentation the contrast between those two things is a little bit symptomatic of the way that the tiering system has been developed. The second, I wanted to provide a public and the regional board evidence that growers are effectively implementing management practices. I really like the term trust and verify. I think that's key. I think that's a central component of what farmers need to do, and I have worked very hard with the growers, driving up and down the coast during the summer, talking and meeting with them to find out how far I could push or how far they would be willing to go in terms of verifying their activity. And I think you'll see that they've come very far. And I will say, if I don't get time, because there's no way I'm going to get 90 slides in 10 minutes, that they have created on some level, I've mostly facilitated conversations, they've created, I think, one of the most provocative and progressive water quality protection programs in the country. Should it be approved. And then finally, to meet the California Water Code, of course. So on some level, it's a question of law and a question of water quality. I believe the proposed third-party option is a robust mechanism to improve and promote water quality improvement. I don't think the draft order, as currently written, will address and make tangible water quality improvements. I do not believe the draft order and the associated, I do believe, sorry, the draft order and associated report reports are confusing. I think they have a lot of internal conflicts, and frankly, they're very hard to figure out how to implement. I think Kay and Brad don't have the time to talk about this at times, but trying to work with growers to figure out what tier they're in was extraordinarily difficult. It was very hard to figure out, especially when you're talking about growers that are changing land tenancies from small to large farms, their rents changing, and the structure of their actual properties of where they are. Now, that is a subset of growers, and I understand that. That's not consistent for all growers. Finally, oh my God, the draft order, I think, does not reflect the stakeholder engagement for the high-risk growers. So I'm going to go on since I have a minute left. We're not going to go there. So enrolled growers begin by submitting a farm plan. The idea of the farm plan is it's auditable. This is not the same as the farm plan that was historically used. It was very hard to figure out what compliance meant. They enrolled growers will do a practice effectiveness and an action plan on their farm. They'd be independently audited 20% per year minimum. A third-party group would rank and prioritize growers. And the idea is that, and I'm going to just go to reporting here because there's no way I'm going to finish. There's a report on each one of these little steps. And Michael, thank you for your little circle. I was hoping that I could copyright this before you guys got there. But the each step, there's a reporting, I'm going to hustle here because I think this is really important. This is not aggregate reporting in the way that the staff have characterized it. The most important thing that you need to see as a board members is, are the practices working in terms of water quality? And so what I tried to do here is give you an idea of what the reporting would look like. This is like slide 12 or something. Grower 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 8, you have all the raw data. It would not be masked into some kind of average. You have the potential for risk in terms of pollution load in nice, hard, yucky colors. Red is bad. White is not so bad. And then at the bottom, an actual measurement of practice effectiveness. So 2 minutes left. The practice effectiveness would basically be used to demonstrate how well farmers are doing. There would be associated reports in terms of lessons learned, what we can do to implement better the strategies, what are the weaknesses of the implementation. And I think probably the most important part of this is blah, 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 blah. Is that this is actually going to create the capacity for farms and farmers to develop a program to look at what research areas need to be developed to promote water quality. One of the fundamental problems in agricultural research over the last probably 50 years is they've been focused on yield and to the exclusion of environmental quality. And this is not even in the University of California, they still have trouble with this. And that's because their mandate is to make sure growers are productive and making money. And so the growers are really stuck. They don't have a dedicated fund to look at research to test different management practices. And so this program, by collecting fees, and the growers are not excited about this, it's $8 to $12 an acre, that half of those fees approximately will be used to make sure that we develop a program that actually improves water quality by testing the practices on the ground. A regular yearly test. So things like If we wanted to focus priorities for 1 year or next, we could focus on groundwater, for example, and look at leaching and try to come up with practices that are really better at preventing groundwater leaching. We could prioritize by watershed. We could prioritize by some groundwater basin. We can prioritize by a specific toxic or a pesticide. We could even prioritize by riparian restoration. You know, in some level, I would be interested in having maybe staff helping us prioritize different kinds of things to do every couple of years. I think that would be a reasonable thing. I think there's, and we've spoken about this in the past, there's a fair amount of distrust, and so it's going to take some time to build that trust back up, but I'm hoping that I can, I'd love to see that happen.
Mr. Jeffries.
Well, you went through that pretty fast.
Yeah. I've got about 80 more.
On your handout, you talked about draft order will not result in tangible water quality improvements. Can you expand upon that a little bit?
Yeah, so it relies on a couple things. The assumption, and I'm going to jump into the shoes of the draft order because it doesn't say what the assumptions are per se. The assumption is that we can use on-farm monitoring to characterize water quality and then use that to prioritize which farms to visit and then maybe make enforcements on the problem areas, right? The problem is that the on-farm monitoring, 4 samples per year, cannot adequately describe water quality leaving a farm. It doesn't describe water quality, it doesn't describe practice effectiveness, and it doesn't describe any kind of trend analysis. To do those things is a very different kind of sampling. Sampling the kind that I like to do with students that cost $30,000 or $40,000 a year. That you have QAPPs, you have a very sophisticated sampling program, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I can do the same thing with a nutrient management plan. The nutrient management plan in the draft order is so vague, so hard to interpret what it means, that the implementation of those two things alone will create an avalanche of reports that the staff are not, one, and they are very qualified in a lot of areas, but interpreting agronomic use of agricultural products like fertilizers and making a reasonable assessment that of the pollution load based on the reports is impossible. I cannot do it. I don't know anyone that can do it from an academic standpoint, and I know in terms of a regulatory context, you're going to be generating a lot of paperwork to prioritize a lot of farms. People are going to make a lot of visits, and they're going to run on those visits, and they're going to say, wow, these reports didn't tell us anything. I'm absolutely sure of that. I'm also sure that you can sample a farm almost a dozen different ways and get different kinds of water quality. Again, I don't know how that improves water quality if we're getting data from a farm that doesn't mean anything.
A few months ago, you gave us a presentation. You gave us a lot of boxes, but you didn't give us much information within those boxes. And there was a question of funding at that particular time. Has the agriculture community, are they continuing to fund you in this program?
No. I'm an idiot, I guess. They hired me in the summer to write a report and meet with growers, and I kind of fell in love with my idea, and I've been kind of working on it on my own since. I also stopped for various reasons, but one of the reasons, I don't have a contract with Water Quality Preservation, Inc. either anymore because I felt like that was a conflict of interest.
If you were to do an analysis of this whole ag order, how much time would it take and what kind of dollars are you looking at?
In terms of from a scientific perspective or
yes.
A policy perspective?
Well, you're looking at scientific as well as policy because you're integrating both ways.
It's a little hard to predict. For example, many of the findings I have trouble with. So, for example, the idea that we are having water quality problems and they're getting worse, that may be, but trend analysis is extremely hard to do, especially when you have depauperate data. What environmental science is really good at is finding a better way to measure pollution and detect pollution as a problem. So I can say for sure we are getting better at detecting pollution in the last 10 years than ever before, granted. I also know starting in 1910 to now, we have a significant lot more agricultural chemicals and a lot more pollution. I can't say that for between 1995 and 2005. That when you decide the time zero is, makes a huge difference in the trend analysis. So a lot of the findings are, we have specific trends in mind, but it's not clear how those are generated. So analysis that far back could take 6 months and $300,000.
Finish your sentence.
If it was more on the implementation of the grant, if it's,
well, I'm hoping somebody will stand up and say, I'll fund the grant for
you.
Yeah,
right, well. in terms of the scientific capacity of water quality to take, to if let's say if we implement the water quality ag order right now, and we spend a year collecting data to see how that would do, about probably $100,000. So go around, collect a bunch of water quality data on lots of farms, measure the water quality that the growers get, and then compare that to what you might get with a more standardized approach. And maybe 30 parcels or so, you could do that, and then compare what they get versus what you get. And my guess is it would be about 50% would be right on. And the other 50% would be, wow, that was way off. But what it wouldn't do is really tell you about practice effectiveness, and that really has to be on each farm separately, and that's a huge project, probably $50,000 per farm, per practice.
Per practice?
Yeah, because you have to have controls, right? So you have to have the practice and a control, which is, you know, science sucks. It's a lot of money.
Well, talking about funding, how much would you anticipate if you took all the acreage, how much would each farmer have to contribute to do all this then? If you're saying $50,000 per practice.
For the research itself?
Yeah. Well, the practice.
For one farm.
For one farm is...
Yeah, 50K or so? Yeah.
So if it was 1,000 acres, it's easy to... I didn't bring my calculator.
Yeah, I can't do math standing in front of you guys.
Okay. I'll go on to my next question.
But let me just say that was part of why I created this $500,000 budget within this program, was that we would be able to do these kinds of on-farm tests. And I actually forced myself to say, you know what, we're going to need the PCAs involved, we're going to need the fertilizer companies, we're going to need the pesticide companies, we're going to have to force them to get a lot of match money, get UC to get on board and do what the kind of research that we really need from them, not the fertility trials, and to really create a collaborative project that growers can get really behind and trust. And I will say, like, I feel like Bobby Martin, he spent a fair amount of money. He's testing a whole bunch of lysimeters right now on his farm. He spent probably $20,000 or $30,000 of his own money to test things. So I think we can leverage a lot of that.
I think that's the reason he left before you spoke, so you wouldn't ask him to open up his wallet.
Yeah.
But my next question is that in the staff report, they talked about five key elements. Do you remember what those
were? Yeah, they were really good. I wish I had them before. I'd like to address them one at a time with more time and sophistication. But I think those are key. Those are key. I think I addressed them, but they said them fast enough that I couldn't jot them down to address them at the time.
Okay.
And I can try.
I was just wondering what your opinion was of those five key elements.
I think they were fine. I don't remember the details. I think they set the bar at a bar that I thought was reasonable and important and worthy of consideration. I don't remember anything jumping out at me.
So you think they're all attainable then?
I didn't write them down. I don't remember. But I thought they were reasonable.
I don't want to go too far in this.
Do you want to pull it up and we can look at it? Is that allowed?
Angela, can you pull that up just please? Appreciate
it. Mr. Jeffries, I just want to say that those five key elements are the key elements in the State Water Board's non-point source policy, and those are what are required to be.
I understand, okay. But
they're just the nice bullets to kind of talk about. Yeah.
Just give his analogy of it. I'm not disputing the elements.
Any money? Okay. Oh. Pollution control that achieves water quality objectives. Yep. Practice management, implementation, and verification. The verification process is the audit process, and the creating that audit process is having an external independent was the idea. And to tell you the truth, half of this, a major portion of this project is to create a context where verification can take place. And the growers were actually very sophisticated in thinking about this in a way that surprised me. When I said, how do you want to do the audit? Do you want? And they said it has to be independent. It's got to be standalone. It's got to be completely transparent in terms of the criteria that people have to be able to evaluate that. We talked about maybe having staff help involved in developing the audit. They were queasy about that, but I think if they didn't have a choice, they could go there.
Transparent to who? The public?
Yeah, and you. I'll make sure I'm not overstepping here. The results wouldn't necessarily be transparent, but the audit criteria standards.
Well, that's what I was referring to, transparent at all stages to the public.
Yeah, so the way that we talked about it in terms of the audit was it could change. These are proposals that I'm negotiating with farmers over a few month period, but the way we talked about it was that those audit results would basically be sort of a pass-fail, and the pass would then that would be passed on to the water board in terms of to show that they've actually met the criteria to meet the audit. Yeah. And frankly, I will say, coming back to the issue of staff time, I thought this does two things. One, it relieves the amount of staff time to try to figure out what's going on all these farms. Two, and I don't know if the growers are appreciating this very much, but on some level, now you have someone that speaks for growers. This has been an ongoing issue in terms of negotiation for the ag waiver, is that every time you talk to growers, you have a different group of growers saying, well, we're not represented. Well, yet it's not us. And here you have a group of growers that are in a group that actually has the capacity to negotiate if there's still problems, and the capacity to come to the table when the staff are seeing problems continue to exist, which I think has been really says something very strong about our region, because the growers in this region are very, very invested and very thoughtful about maintaining a professional organization. I think Water Quality Preservation, Inc. is an outstanding example of that. I think in most cases, it's extremely professionally.
That ought to be worth a few bucks.
Any other questions, Mr. Jeffries?
No, I think I had one more question, but I'm sure that would take a couple hours to.
Okay. Mr. Johnston.
Mr. Los Huertos, trust but verify. And I think that's a lot of what the whole conundrum is coming down to. That's one of the big issues, if not the biggest, in this whole back and forth and back and forth between the staff draft and the ag alternative. And it's kind of funny, because usually farmers and business people in general are protective of proprietary information because they don't want their competitors to see it. Here it's because they don't want us, the board, and the public to see it. And it certainly does give us a queasy feeling, in terms of how do we do the verify part of the trust but verify. I'm looking at those key elements over there, and management practice implementation and verification. I understand you're saying the audits would verify, but we're the folks who swore an oath to actually uphold the law and to make sure this stuff is getting done. And there's So I have questions about what we can delegate about that. Similarly, and it has a little bit to do with all five of those, but similarly in number five, consequences for failure to achieve objectives and individual dischargers really having the responsibility and being accountable. And so, I mean, I really get the concept that we can accomplish some things collaboratively that we cannot accomplish with a straight stick approach. I get that. But I'm just wondering, and I understand that you don't speak for agriculture, that you're simply speaking as in a sense an expert because you've, as an outsider, done a lot of talking and interviewing. And so I'm just looking for your opinion here and hoping I don't mess you up on your future ability to get contracts from farmers. But, I mean, do you see some creative ways to deal with that conundrum? Because right now we've got really kind of a immovable object and an unstoppable force on this question. Is it having staff that can review the audits, but the audits aren't turned in? I mean, that answers one piece of it. It doesn't answer the public's piece of it. Is it having the audits published, and maybe staff on an on-farm basis looked at them and know where they're applicable, but they're published without an identity? I don't know, but if we can't work through that one, it's not clear to me how we come to resolution on this. And I've heard the legal arguments from agriculture as to why that's not necessary, and I've heard the legal arguments from our council as to why it is. And personally, as I can't speak for any of the other board members, but it's a pretty high threshold for me to simply discount our council's arguments and say, okay, fine, I'm going to go with what they say. They have an interest in it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's another. There's a lot in there. Let me begin with something that I was reflecting on with Daniel Press actually two nights ago about this issue for a couple hours. And he talked about that really Porter Cologne and Clean Water Act are policy failures. They're ambient water quality programs with point source regulatory tools. And on some level, non-point source pollution got stuck in the middle. And it's an awkward, uncharted territory. And I thought that was pretty compelling. I didn't know what to do with it, but I thought it was compelling. And I thought, when I thought about that, it turns out that when you think about this sort of land that we don't know what to do with yet, we really need to step back and look at the sort of the long-term goals of what we're trying to achieve. We have a huge number of people that are managing a lot of land in our region. And on some level, we're looking for two things to happen. Besides water quality improvement, to get there, we need cooperation from them. So I have to admit, it seems to me that on some level, this is not necessarily a regulatory issue, but a political issue. And as a political issue, we probably need to think in terms of long-term goals. So I would say the 2004 was a very good start. It got people regulated that weren't used to being regulated, and it put them in a place where they understood what water quality problems were in the region. When they start paying the bill to see Sarah Daphnia die from their waters, they get it. They don't know what to do with it yet. We do not have the practices available to make the water non-toxic. I don't know how to farm and fertilize a field without nitrate leaving the soil. That's how ag works. The salts don't get taken up, the nitrogen does. You can't get 100%. Usually it's around, at the best we can get about 80%. It's a US EPA report is around 80%. In that context, we are in a very stuck place. We want agriculture to remain present and productive, and we want very high water quality that we are, frankly, not just deserve, I think we have a right to. Getting there is going to take some creativity. And I would say that the creativity that we're trying, that I've tried to create some space for, is a creativity to say, let's work on practices that really are getting there, and I want that stick of the regional board staff to enforce the waiver in the alternative proposal in the way that they have and can enforce even the 2004 waiver. I think the most effective enforcement is random inspections on farms wherever you are. I think it sends a message to Tier 1, 2, and 3. You don't get a pass at any level. You only have to do a few in every watershed, and believe me, the word gets out.
Dr. Los Huertos, could you quickly conclude? Because we could go on indefinitely.
I think I'm there. I think I'm there.
I don't know if that answers your question.
It didn't answer my question at all, but it was interesting.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah. Dr. Hunter, you didn't have any questions? Okay. All right.